Hello, and welcome to the Five Borough Play Festival podcast. My name is Oscar Portillo, and I am your host. On today's episode, we have a conversation with writer Brian Davis. Brian and I had a long conversation at Brooklyn College's beautiful campus. We discussed everything from horror movies to his play, Lex Talionis, a play about death and grief and dealing with those emotions. Brian talks about what his inspirations were for writing this play and how growing up in Brooklyn has affected his writing style. I hope you enjoy his conversation as much as I did. How did you come about writing this play?
At first, it was going to be like a 10-minute play. You know, it was just originally just going to be Edward, the main character, meeting with Sid, and then who's not one of the other main characters,
right?
And then as I was writing the thing, I was like, well, why don't I have some why don't I just have Edward have a little intro, just to make sure, this is not something that's going to be happening unless off the spur of the moment. Mm-hmm. And then as I'm writing the thing, okay, why don't I just make it even more longer? It's like really expanded. So by the time I was actually done with the thing, it was probably around maybe 32 pages at least. 32 pages in play forms. So I originally wrote Lex Talionis for 40 plus pages. Mm-hmm. So that's easily enough for like a one-act play festival, though, for those who,
like a French festival where you have to go in and out and, go see a different show.
Yeah.
Instead of like, you're at one thing.
Yeah. And the 30-minute version still feels and flows like an actual play. Mm-hmm. So even though I had to take out like the most crucial part of the play, it still comes across as being presentable in more along the lines of, hey, this is okay, this is actually a slice of life, something that could be actually happening,
right?
Even though there are like supernatural elements within that play.
Well, what brought you to write about this specific subject? Because this play is about grief and death and sort of coming to understand what death is. I mean, that's what I'm taking away from it.
I was going through a couple of years ago, my grandmother unfortunately passed away.
Oh,
so,
sorry.
Thank you. And I was unsure how to process it because I wasn't. When she passed away and up to the point where I actually graduated, I wasn't sure how I was actually processing everything because mm-hmm. I was going through a lot of personal shit.
Sure.
Excuse me, French. And after once I was able to graduate from BMCC, which was a hill unto itself because I had originally gone to Kingsborough, getting my associate's degree at the tail end of what was happening with me, how I was personally, mm-hmm. was really, really...
Everything was coming to a point.
It was coming to a point where I was legitimately unsure how to process everything because mm-hmm. one, my grandmother just passed away, early, like right before the summer started, mm-hmm. Right around my birthday too.
Oh.
So every time my birthday rolls around now, it's much more of a somber day for me.
Right.
And then the summer came and went. I was like, you know what? Summer is like, it's going good for me, and so I'm going to Coney Island. I'm going to see shows there. They usually do like flicks on the beach, where it's like they just play movies on the beach.
And right, and everyone brings a chair and a towel,
or just sits on like the boardwalk, and just watch it from the light of the boardwalk. Mm-hmm. And as I was going through the motions of summer, it's like okay, summer's going good for me. And then once that fall semester hit, it was like everything just came out. Everything just started coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And while I was like in the motions of rediscovering myself emotionally, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess in the back of my mind, I was like, I need to figure out a way to convey what I was feeling. And as a writer, I'm like, okay, what is my strongest suit? Okay, it's like my strongest suit I write is very supernatural stuff, because there isn't anything that I ain't writing that isn't related to something like very horror or supernatural or paranormal, okay. Something like that. Something that isn't, when there's something more than meets the eye.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like something that isn't like, that doesn't have the necessary qualities of being reality, but still is part of reality itself. So there's like this little...
right in the middle. Like it's something that you can't feel or see, but you know it's there.
Exactly.
Right. And I think when your Edward speaks to that, where he's, I don't believe in religion, but I believe there's something out there that's controlling our fate.
And I grew up in the Catholic faith, all that stuff.
Where did you grow up?
Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
I grew up in Bensonhurst. So I went to one Catholic school. I mean, I partially went to Catholic school there. I went there for like a couple of years, and then I went back to normal schools. But I still went to Sunday school, so because because as a Catholic, you know, it's like
you have to do that. Yeah, I grew up Catholic too.
Yeah, it's like 8 years of just going to Catholic school. I'm like, I don't want to go to Catholic school, but no, it's gotta go to Catholic school.
Yep.
But yeah, as I was growing up, it was like I'm still Catholic by nature, so I still believe in, you know, God, you know, the devil, you know, all that stuff. And it's like, I still
Catholic guilt. So that's something that resonated with me very much as soon as I read it. And I was like, Catholic guilt. Yeah, that's perfect what it is, because you're taught to forgive everything, and you want to be forgiven by, you know, God. But if you don't forgive, you feel guilty for not forgiving, but you shouldn't have to if you don't feel that emotion. And that resonated with me reading the play. And I was just like, 100% understand that.
Yeah, it's like it's just those things that just resonate you as someone who grew up as a Catholic, mm-hmm. or someone who knows Catholic friends and who knows what you're talking about. It's like when someone, even if you're not Catholic and you hear one of your friends is like, oh, I have Catholic guilt. I'm like, oh, okay, I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's just one of those things, and that's something I actually wrote in the play. It's like, you know, one of the characters, Gabrielle, she goes, you know, and Catholic guilt resides in me, or something along the lines like that, and. Yeah.
Now, in your play, you have Sid, who is the Grim Reaper.
One of them.
So all three of them are. That's what something.
I mean, no, it's
or some sort of fate decider.
I honestly believe that Sid is more along the lines of the Grim Reaper, but he's also probably like the ferryman. He's carrying you on to the other side, but in Sid's case, he's just more along the lines of just testing people out before he could actually, he or she could actually, you know,
pass on.
Let them pass on, see if they're a good mortal or not, or if they aren't living their lives per se to how they were fated to be, then they could easily just go, you're done. You know, I don't care who you are, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing about writing Sid, that is originally I just wrote it as being a very, come on, guy, and it was like very fun-loving type of person, and then as Sid was slowly starting to actually come about and actually doing that, Sid just became much more of an idea than a character, and that's actually something that really resonates, because it doesn't matter who's actually playing Sid, the character itself is much more of an idea and much more of a powerful statement than it is anybody else in the play.
Right. You said you started out with him trying to be a fun character. Is
that, yeah.
Because he turns out to be much more nurturing and
yeah. I kind of like wrote him as like of like one of those abrasive type of psychologists you probably see on TV.
Because
that's why I always say, he's like, you don't look like a psychologist. And Sid would just go, first off, that's racist. Because it's like, you know, it's like, something that actually, like the first moment you see Sid, it's him asking for a quarter, because I originally had him as someone, it's like, because I originally had Sid in the back of my mind when I first wrote this. Sid was one of those people that you see fall asleep in the hospital. I'm sure if they're a patient there or homeless or just someone who's just like, just waiting for something.
Mm-hmm.
So with him waking up and it's like asking for a quarter, it's like, okay, there's this figure that's like right there. And I want to develop that person as a character. I know who Edward is already, but mm-hmm. who is Sid? And for me, writing Sid was just more along the lines of what I was... and this is what the question you were asking before was, like, how did I kind of, like why was I writing this play? Mm-hmm. And in the back of my mind, Sid was basically allowing me to understand that, yes, death happens all the time, and, you know, I can't really stop death. You know, you can't really stop... Because even if you cheat death, and you even know when you're actually going to die and all that stuff, you know, it's like, if you know when and where you're going to die, what is the point of living? Because you just
right,
be like,
and you have Gabrielle say that in the play as well.
Yeah.
There's no point to living if I know when I'm going to die.
Yeah.
It's just you're waiting for that moment to happen at that
yeah.
point.
So there's no real fun of just being, just, you know, living life, essentially.
So I feel like Sid is the middle, while you have Gabrielle is more on, like, the compassionate side, and even more than Sid, as in, like, she wants to make sure that everyone lives type
yeah,
of thing,
even,
and then a doctor is more of the darker side? Is that
yeah,
how you kind of...
Yeah, that's actually how I envision it. Gabrielle is someone who is human, by the way. She isn't...
Oh, okay, she is human. Okay.
Yeah, she is human. She okay. has human nature. She is a human person. But it's more... But she does represent the good side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the... She messed up long ago, and she hasn't really forgiven herself, hence the whole Catholic guilt mm-hmm. Joke. And then there's Sid, who is practically the mill. And as the mill man, or mill person, I should say, he's more along the lines of making sure everything goes to plan or everything doesn't go to plan. And Sid is one of those people who actually loves to annoy people and test with people, hence the whole thing I mentioned, like, you know, he's just someone who loves to test people out.
Right. And
there's Dr. Collins, who is more or less the strictly business type of Grim Reaper who you probably see in most media. It's like, if you think of a Grim Reaper, you think of someone long, black coat, I mean, black cloak,
right,
hood.
Hood with the scythe.
And, yeah. You know. That's just Dr. Collins normally. Dr. Collins is someone who is all business. They
Got
don't,
it.
You know, they don't care if it's who you are. They have a quota, and they need to make up that quota.
Right, and that's why he was so annoyed that Sid had changed the fate of of Edward's wife.
Yeah, and that was another thing with Sid. It's like, okay, so it's like, how would I explain why is Sid doing all this? It's like, even if you're the Grim Reaper, or, you know, or someone who works with the Grim Reaper, you know, it's like, when the Grim Reaper itself knows, like, hey, this underling is messing things up. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure Sid was in the middle, because if there wasn't a middle character, then the play wouldn't be...
It'd just be two extremes, and it's good versus evil without a more complex middle person.
And having Sid as a legitimate middle person makes it much more interesting, because Sid is legitimately a Grim Reaper. Sid essentially just became a lot more funner to write once I knew where I was going with this character.
Now, you named the play Lex Talionis, which is Eye for an Eye in Latin. How did you come about that title? Because the only event where there is revenge involved is Edward seeking revenge on his.
And also Gabrielle seeking revenge for her sister's assault.
So is that why you named it Eye for an Eye, or is that how you came about that title?
Oh, no. This actually was something much more funnier. I was actually writing a log line. As a screenwriter, I have all these log lines. I have like maybe 14 pages worth of just log lines, ideas I have. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do all these, you know, stuff.
No, they're just seeds. You plant seeds, and then at some point, maybe one of them will pop up in your head, and you want a story.
And I was talking to my friends, and I was like, guys, I have a military thriller. It's practically like, it's like a court, it's like it's set in New York City. It's court-martialed in New York City. You know, you'd not be able to leave the island. You know, it's like, so it's basically self-contained. And I'm like, I need a good name for it. I'm running out of names. And one of my friends, Dylan, he told me this name. What about Lex Talionis? It's Latin. It's called Eye for an Eye. It's good for, it's like, you if you think of a military stuff, chances are there's probably some Latin term somewhere tossed in somewhere. And I'm like, okay, good. I'll just keep that as a name for this military thriller. Years later, I'm writing the play, and originally this play was called The Point of No Return.
Okay.
And I actually have Point of No Return, like, somewhere in the thing.
That's, yeah, I think you have Sid say he's almost, about Edward, he's almost to the point of no return.
Exactly. Right. And I was like, okay, I'm just like, okay, Point of No Return. I'm like, come on, I could do better than this. And as I was reading, it was like reading through my old notes, I just see Lex Talionis. I'm like, wait a minute, Lex Talionis, what was that about again? It's like, I'm like, okay.
There you go.
It's like, yeah. When it comes with the Point of No Return, it's like the Point of No Return. I'm like,
yeah. Whenever I think of that, I think of Phantom of the Opera. Yeah. So,
yeah. I'm like, I don't want something. I didn't want to do something very basic and, you know, like cheesy in terms of the title. But when you read the title Lex Talionis, and you know Latin, it automatically catches like an actual Latin, like Latin, the actual language. Like people who don't speak Latin are probably, you know, professors who really hate their jobs. Although I really kid about that. There are professors who really love their jobs.
But yeah, of course. There's both. You know, yeah. And I've had lots of both.
Yeah, but there's probably professors who probably hate doing that job because you're basically teaching people a dead language.
Right.
And Latin itself, from what I read and like read itself, it comes across as being very, very hard to like say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to look up how to say Talionis.
I actually didn't know how to say Talionis. I always kept on saying it was Italian, not like Italian, a Talon. Because I kept on saying a Talon, because I kept on saying it was Talon, Talononis, something like that. But when my director, but last year I had this actually produced and performed at Mahan Repertory Theater in Mahan.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So that was sort of like my director at that thing, Danny, he said it was actually pronounced as Lex Talionis. So I was like, okay, that's actually more.
Sounds a lot better.
Sounds a lot better than Talionis, as someone who's from Brooklyn and has a very bad accent speaking. A lot of my words just comes up very jumbled up, so.
Sure, I can understand that.
And so it's like, I'd be like, it's very hard to actually say certain words without having that little Brooklyn in there.
Yeah, of course, you're gonna have some Brooklyn in it. What inspired you to get into theater? Like, how did you get your start? Did you start in high school? Did you see a play that you really enjoyed?
Okay,
a movie?
There's a couple of answers to that.
Give me all.
Okay. The two quickest answers I have is one of my cousins is actually an actress.
Okay.
And she's been on Broadway. She's done musicals. She's done television.
That is amazing.
Movies. And she was actually a series regular on Orange is the New Black. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. She played a character in Norma. Or is it? Is it Nora or Norma? She was like the quiet one.
Norma?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Yeah, she's my cousin.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
So I always heard stories of her being in movies and whatnot. And when I was growing up in my high school, they was like, Brian, you have a nice voice for radio, or you have a nice voice for like. It's like, why don't you be an actor, all that stuff? It was mostly because of my cousin. But then as I grew older, I just discovered, you know, stuff about acting. It's like, I just wanted to do this as a, you know, I just wanted to primarily become like an actor. And I grew up watching a lot of films, and I'm talking about a lot of films.
Like what? What were the things that you would watch the most of?
Total Recall, Die Hard, RoboCop. But yeah, I was always fascinated with stuff like Die Hard, RoboCop, Total Recall, which apparently I watched the most as a child.
Did you?
Apparently I watched Total Recall the most as a child.
That's awesome. So like action, sci-fi-ish?
Yeah, that sort of stuff growing up. And then when I got older, it was like I just started transitioning into horror-related works.
Right, and that's how you came up to this supernatural thing that you enjoy writing about, which is that's awesome. Yeah.
No, because I originally grew up being scared of horror, and then by the time all right, quick anecdote. I grew up very scared of horror. Uh-huh. And then by around maybe 1998, 1999, around that time, I was flipping through channels and Halloween H2O was on and I was catching end of it. And I just see Jamie Lee Curtis take a friggin' axe to Michael Myers' head. And as I'm watching this scene, I'm like, and Michael Myers is practically begging for his life. I'm like, wait a minute. Let me just back up here a second. This is the guy I'm supposed to be terrified of. A guy who's practically begging for his life. And he goes out like...
And he gets killed.
It's like he's going out and it's like he's practically begging his, you know, sister, spoiler, although. But yeah, I just grew up hating horror. And then I just saw the scene from H2O. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, why am I so scared of Michael Myers? He's going out like a chump. Mm-hmm. And then I just grew into more horror-related work. And, you know, my parents, my family was like, why are you watching horror movies, all this stuff? I'm like, I'm just used to it now. It's like, I'm just used to it. I grew up very scared. Now I'm like, hey, my man Freddy, how you doing?
So you watch a lot of, so a lot of film, yeah, as you were growing up, and that's what got you into theater.
Oh, the other thing that actually got me into theater was that this was a way long time ago, I forgot when, but it was when Beauty and the Beast was first on Broadway.
Okay.
And my parents got tickets to that. Mm-hmm. And I was all the way up in the bleachers or wherever it's like the like balcony or around, mm-hmm, that thing. But it was like my first Broadway production, and seeing that from first to start, it was like so amazing to see. So those two things, my cousin being part of being an actress,
being in the industry, uh-huh,
being in the industry, and seeing Beauty and the Beast first when it was on Broadway for the first time. So this is like my own 1994, and you know, this is when Beauty and the Beast was probably still being, you know, on video and whatnot.
Right.
So yeah,
you have to go get the VHS cassette.
Yeah. Right. So those two events and the fact that I was watching a lot of films around that time, it was legitimately those primary reasons why I got into theater.
That's amazing. That's, yeah, awesome. Talk about growing up in Bensonhurst, Beth Beach. I worked in Crown Heights for a couple years, and I had friends who lived out in Sheepshead and in Midwood, but I've never heard anything about Bensonhurst other than it's by the beach.
All right. Well, it is practically by the beach. We're kind of like a stone's throw away from Coney Island, so, mm-hmm, basically, you know, if you're on the B-64 or the D-train, you're there in like maybe 20 minutes.
That's awesome.
By train, I mean.
So did you spend a lot of time at the beach, or you just, you know, actually, were you an indoors kind of kid?
Actually, I never really went to the beach until after going after Kingsborough. Because after Kingsborough, I had that like that gap period between dropping out of Kingsborough, mm, to going to BMCC. But during that time, I started going to the beach and I started walking around the beach, taking pictures and whatnot. You know, really really enjoying the fact I was going to Coney Island. It's like I walk a lot. So
I mean, walking is fantastic. I have a boss right now who walks from uptown Manhattan all the way downtown Manhattan to get home. He will not take a cab, will not take a train. He will walk it the whole way. And it's about, you know, 8 miles to walk every day. It's amazing. I don't understand how people do that. I'd rather drive.
Well, if you've ever taken a cab or driven in Manhattan or even taken a train in Manhattan or a bus in Manhattan, you know why.
Yeah, I mean, it took me 2 hours to get home last night, and it was not fun. But, I mean, I enjoy driving in Manhattan. I'm just a crazy person.
Yeah. But, yeah, I grew up in Bensonhurst. I grew up in a very... When I originally went there, I mean, when I grew up there, it was originally like a Catholic neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But as the years went on by, all the old the Italians out this moved out of the area, and it was practically us and probably a couple other people that's still living there, that's within that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Because now it's all, now my neighborhood is practically almost gentrified. Growing up in Bensonhurst, very lovely neighborhood.
Does that translate to your writing? Is how you grew up? Because I know, I mean, you mentioned a couple neighborhoods in Lex Talianus, and I don't know if you've done it in other plays, but does that influence your writing, where you grew up?
Definitely. Especially with someone living in Brooklyn, I normally name drop a lot of Brooklyn neighborhoods, and you know, most of them, and then I forget, oh yeah, I'll be like, Brian, there are other neighborhoods in Manhattan and New York City. I'm like, oh yeah. I was like, I gotta go and start writing all the neighborhoods down. I was like, do I really have to write someone's from like, it's like someone is coming from Long Island, like Long Island. No, I'm like, I'm from Brooklyn. I'm like, I just want to keep everything within Brooklyn.
So when you write your plays, do you like to keep local, or like your settings are usually local, or even when you're writing, you said you also write, your screenwriter. So whenever you write for the screen,
I try to keep everything New York City wise, because I feel like, I honestly do feel like New York City, even though it is like the bread and butter of the theater world or the filmmaking world, it is one of the highest points in the more extreme high points in the entertainment world. It's just that a lot of these media things, they always focus on places in Manhattan.
Yeah.
They don't focus on places like in the Bronx. They don't focus on places in the Queens. And the only times in Queens you actually get focused on it is like Spider-Man. It's like, I don't remember.
It's not even that much. It's like, yeah, maybe it's like, just a little bit of Sunnyside.
Or Forest Hills. I'm like, like that. And then it's back to Manhattan. Mm-hmm. But yeah, growing up in Bensonhurst, it was really fun. It's still fun. It still is fun. But in terms of keeping everything local, I try to keep everything local in terms of just being in Brooklyn. Because I want to have much more of a storyline in terms of like the five boroughs in terms of my writing.
Sure.
Like, I want to have like things connected into like one way into another. It's like, if something's gonna be happening in Manhattan, I have to have another story that's set in the Bronx, or maybe in Queens, or maybe in Staten Island. But yeah, I just want to have people to read or watch this play and just come across as being, okay, I've been through this point where it's like, you know, I've been through this point, and like, this is like the point where everything changed for me. So yeah.
No, that's awesome. And I think it does do that. And I mean, for me, I related to the points about death and Catholic guilt, and it is something that I will remember, and it has stuck by me. So thank you for the interview.
Oh yeah.
And thank you for your time, and good luck with the school. I wish you the best, and I wish you graduate, and I also wish you the best with this play other works you do.
Hey, I love to hear myself talk.
And there you have it. Again, thank you to Brian for sitting down and talking to me, and thank you for listening. Please go check out Lex Talionis and the rest of the wonderful plays at the festival. And if it's too late, don't worry, I'm sure they'll pop up again real soon. Thank you, and see you on the next one. Special thank you to Intar for the space for this year's Play Festival, Fail Better for helping develop the work, and LaGuardia Performing Arts Center for their rehearsal space. The Five Borough Play Festival podcast is produced by Diana Sanchez and me, Oscar Portillo. Music by bensound.com.